This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
There's more than one war over Christmas. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Some conservative Christians and commentators on Fox News have claimed there's a liberal plot to de-Christianize Christmas. Department stores that wish customers happy holidays have been criticized, even boycotted. But other Christians say President Bush and Republicans in Congress have missed the message of Christ by helping the rich at the expense of the poor. On To the Point, we'll talk to Christian leaders about the meaning of Christmas in a country of increasing religious diversity. On Reporter's Notebook later on, trains, buses, and subways are rolling again in New York City. We'll hear about the end of the transit strike. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Debate about the meaning of Christmas has reached a crescendo this season, with arguments about happy holidays and helping the rich at the expense of the poor. On To the Point, we'll talk with a variety of Christian leaders at a time of increasing religious diversity in America. On Reporter's Notebook, New York's illegal transit strike is over. What's the message for labor relations with public employees? First, this news update. The National Archives have released more than 700 pages of documents involving Judge Samuel Alito. He, of course, the president's latest nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court. They show that he advocated immunity for government officials who authorized wiretaps of American citizens without asking courts for warrants. Joe Becker is an investigative reporter who filed a Freedom of Information request for The Washington Post. Joe Becker, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us more about what's in here.
Well, this is already getting a lot of traction on the Hill, of course, because President Bush is under attack for bypassing the courts in order to order warrantless domestic wiretapping of suspected terrorists. But there are some key differences. Sam Alito at this time, a Reagan lawyer, wasn't defending warrantless wiretaps. But what he was saying was that even when high-ranking officials, the attorney general, knowingly breaks the law and orders warrantless, that they should be immune from suit. So likely to be controversial, particularly among Democrats who are pressing the president on this issue and see it as a good election issue.
Now, this issue came up during the Nixon administration when the attorney general at the time authorized a warrantless suit, warrantless wiretap, and was sued by somebody who was overheard as a result. So that's how it came up. What happened in that case involving John Mitchell, who was the attorney general at the time?
Well, actually, it's sort of interesting because even though Sam Alito said that he believed that there should be absolute immunity, he cautioned against the Reagan administration making that argument, in fact, because he said the court wasn't going to agree with them, and in fact, he was right. However, Don Mitchell did, the court did say that he had qualified immunity. In other words, if he didn't knowingly break the law, then he couldn't be sued, and there was a dispute about whether or not he knowingly broke the law, because the law at that time was unclear.
So then again, as you indicated, Judge Alito was arguing at the time that even if the official involved knew that he was violating the law, he should have immunity. But he recommended not going ahead full bore. I said that, as you indicated, that it would be likely to lose. How does that compare to the kind of legal strategy that he has proposed, or he did propose when he was in the Justice Department, with regard to abortion rights?
Well, I think what these documents showed, especially taken together, is that this is a cautious lawyer who is sort of keenly aware of the politics of the Supreme Court. In the document in which a case involving the first time that the Reagan administration argued that Roe v. Wade ought to be overturned, he said, be careful. He clearly articulated his agreement with the goal, but said, Now, be careful. I have a better idea. You know, we should chip away at it, not do this frontal assault because court may not take kindly to it. In that case, they did go ahead and do the frontal assault, and the court essentially ignored them and just didn't respond to the issue. But it is interesting. He's a young lawyer, and in both of those cases, older superiors sort of said, "Nope, we are going to go full bore." And in both cases, it didn't work out.
Okay. So again, might make a big difference that he was, if he were on the court, what the senators are going to be interested in when the Judiciary Committee has hearings, presumably, is that he agreed with those goals rather than the strategy.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And in this latest document, I think there'll be a lot of questions about what sort of checks he thinks are appropriate for executive branch officials in fighting the war on terrorism.
Did you expect to find this when you filed your Freedom of Information request? I presume not.
Well, I was, you can always hope that you'll find more information that educates the public. I had hoped to get a little more sense of who he was, and I think that this accomplished that.
700 pages. You haven't had a lot of time to look through it all at this point. Anything else that looks interesting?
A couple of other things. I mean, one is I think overall you have a sense that he is sort of a believer in a strong executive, in strong presidential powers, and in a separate memo he makes a sort of complicated argument about how the president could exert sort of some influence on how the courts might see congressional legislation and its sort of strategy to protect against what they saw as judicial activism in interpreting laws passed by Congress. But I think that's a theme that you see sort of throughout his writings and subsequent speeches.
All right. A lot for him to think about and for the senators to think about between now and I think it's the 9th of January when the Judiciary Committee will meet. Joe Becker, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Investigative reporter for The Washington Post. In a moment, the so-called war over Christmas on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. This year, the American Family Association released a bulletin asking its members to contact Target, Sears, Lowe's, Office Max, Kmart, Staples, Home Depot, and Kohl's. The purpose was, quote, to let them know you are offended by their anti-Christian and anti-Christmas bias. Tim Wildman is president of the American Family Association. Mr. Wildman, thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Warren.
What did you mean by anti-Christian, anti-Christmas bias?
Well, we surveyed most all the large major retail chains and department stores back in late November because this is the Christmas shopping season and they make 20 to 25% of their profits annually this time of year, and found almost zero mentions of Christmas or Merry Christmas or acknowledgments of Christmas Day. Everything was holiday oriented, and we thought we think that's taking Christmas away and the word away from its appropriate use this time of year, and it's a change that's been made not only in the corporate world but also obviously in schools and other places, and we think it's time to get Christmas back in Christmas.
Fox News is among those news outlets that's calling this a war on Christmas. One of their commentators has even written a book with that title. Do you agree that that's what's going on?
Yes, I think there are 1,000 different brush fires across America with related to this story of Christmas and the attempt by some to get, you know, Christmas to be watered down to just to be a holiday or in some cases no celebration of Christmas, even though it's a federal holiday in some school systems, for instance. So I think it does represent, if you look at it collectively, a war on Christmas across America.
And who's responsible for it? Is it liberals? Is it secularists? Who do you think is behind it?
I do think you probably find a lot of liberals who love Christmas, and I'm a conservative, and I still say that. I think there is a secularist group, the ACLU types, the Americans United for Separation of Church and State types, who have sort of an absolutist view against any form or mention of religion, particularly Christianity, in the public square. And so I think they have been very influential, and they're responsible for this.
Back to the commercial sector, there are those who have pointed out that many people in the United States are not Christians. Some of them are, in fact, Jews who have Hanukkah coming up right now, a holiday that they are supporting. And it's being said that those stores, for example, that you asked your people to contact simply are trying to recognize the diversity of their customer base and appeal to everybody.
Well, then say Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah, if that's what they want to do. Let's be honest here. 1 to 2% of the public are Jewish. I don't know what percentage of those people actually celebrate Hanukkah to the point of going out and buying gifts. However, 96% of the public say they celebrate Christmas, and 80%+ of the American public identify with the Christian faith in one way or another. So, again, Christmas has been a federal holiday since 1870, so this is not to be insensitive, certainly to Jewish people who celebrate Hanukkah, but my goodness, if you went to Israel, I don't think you would expect a Christian holiday to be the main emphasis any time of year, and Christmas has always been the centerpiece of the holiday season in a traditionally Christian country, and we shouldn't be embarrassed of that or feel like we're being insensitive to others because we want to be inclusive of the majority.
Israel, of course, is quite openly a religious state. The United States is not, and in fact, there's supposed to be separation of church and state in the United States. Does that make a difference?
No, I'm talking culturally here, and I'm talking the religious affiliation of the people of the country. That's going to be reflected in what dominates the celebration with respect to holidays. And I'm just saying the vast majority of people in this country are Christian, if they are of any religious persuasion at all, and that's why the public celebrates the birth of Christ in many different ways.
Tim Wildman, again, president of the American Family Association. That's a traditional values advocacy organization. Jim Wallace is editor of Sojourners Magazine for Sojourners. That's a 30-year-old Christian activist organization. He's also author of God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. Jim Wallace, welcome to you.
Hi, good to be here.
Do you think there's a war on Christmas?
Well, I find this rather amazing and even amusing. To say that the scandal of Christmas this year is Target and retail stores not saying, you know, Merry Christmas, but Happy Holidays instead, I'm not sure what's victory here, saying, welcome to Target, we honor Christ here, and don't miss a 20% off sale. I think that's a bit missing the point. Now, there was a real Christmas scandal, I think, this past week in a federal budget, a budget which cut vital services to poor families and kids and cut taxes for the wealthy, increased the deficit for our grandchildren. Christmas Eve is tomorrow, and if we go to church, we might hear Mary's prayer, Magnificat, in which she says, "My soul doth magnify the Lord." And then she goes on to say, "He will put down the mighty from their thrones, exalt those of low degree, fill the hungry with good things, and send the rich empty away." So a Congress this week reversed the priorities of Mary. They filled the rich with good things and sent the hungry empty away. Now that strikes me as a more serious Christmas scandal.
Should the United States Congress be legislating according to the Bible?
No, I'm just saying, as a person of faith, I, as all the guests on the show, reserve the right to try to apply my faith to politics. No, we should argue, as we did last week, a number of church leaders and faith-based folks that this kind of budget is against the common good. It's bad for all of us. It happens to be in our Christmas season when there used to be a special attention to those who are poor. Now it's all shopping. The scandals about shopping news. I remember I read somewhere that Bill O'Reilly had something like 50 interviews or hits on this Christmas scandal, but not a word about Darfur, the genocide going on in Darfur right now. So I think this misses the point. In the public square, we argue over the common good. I would argue that in a time of war and rising poverty and record deficits and natural disaster is not a time to cut vital services for poor people, cut taxes on the wealthiest, and increase deficits. Now, I would argue that on the basis of common good, but I'm informed, I'm motivated by my own Christian faith, and I'm saying at Christmas time, Mary reminds us to think about the poor, not about all the gifts we're going to buy for our own kids.
Jim Wallace with Sojourners Magazine. Back to Tim Wildman with the American Family Association. What do you say to that, you're missing the point if you don't focus on what happened in Congress?
Well, man, that federal budget is so huge and hard to understand for the average person, including myself sometimes. I don't know what to think. I do know that the Christian calling is to help support the charities and people in need and the hungry and the poor, and I think we can individually do that with our own financial donations to either our churches, our local charity efforts like soup kitchens or Salvation Army and those kinds of efforts, which I personally give to. I think that's a much more effective way to help people individually than the government, myself. That's the way I lean. So, you know, I guess we could argue about what the priorities should be in government and how we should spend money. Some people feel like there's so much waste in all these social programs that they don't really feel like they're being effective. And I know that's some of the feeling of people I'm around.
Jim Wallace, back to you with Sojourners. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, the people who came to Washington last week are the ones who serve the poor every single day. They do soup kitchens and pantries and clinics. They're faith-based organizations, and some of them voted for the president last time and some not. But they came because this budget hurts poor people. They wanted to cut food stamps and health care and low-income education for college kids. Poverty is rising in America. The policies of the Bush administration are causing more poverty in this country. And Christians came to say to this administration and the Congress, stop hurting the people that we're supporting. Of course, we should all do what we could individually in churches, but churches can't provide health care for 44 million Americans. Our budgets don't allow that. So to say government has no role to play, government is cutting taxes for the wealthy, cutting services for the poor, increasing deficits for our kids. Now, that's irresponsible. And so in addition to what we all must do at home and should be in our neighborhoods, the Bible holds kings and rulers and judges and courts accountable. This is not, the Bible doesn't talk about individual charity. The Bible talks about economic justice.
You don't think, as Tim Wildman said, that the budget is so huge and difficult to understand that it's hard to draw conclusions about it?
No. I mean, it is true that the budget is huge and hard to understand. And if members of Congress, wanted us to understand, they could make it more clear. It's in their interest that we don't understand. But one thing that people who are serving poor people do understand is that these cuts, and we've studied them carefully, are going to hurt poor families and kids. And I said before, a bridge to nowhere doesn't help the people in Darfur. Half the money there could have helped save lives in Darfur. I mean, Christians care more about what emblazons the shopping mall as we walk in to buy more stuff. We care about human rights around the world, global poverty, HIV, AIDS, trafficking, all these things that we care about, and poverty here at home. So this is more to the point, not what our shopping malls say at Christmas time.
So, Tim Wildman, back to you, the American Family Association. What about this, that the priorities are wrong, that these broad social issues are more important than what happens at the shopping mall?
I just disagree that it's the government's responsibility to take care of everybody. I mean, my goodness, where do we stop with programs, and how do we make them efficient, and when do we quit taxing people who are working hard and earning that money? you know, I'm not as well versed on it as this gentleman is, obviously, but I just philosophically don't think it's our job to take care of the world and the country he mentioned, Sudan, I think it was. So we can do what we can do, but America just can't take care of everybody.
Tim Wildman of the American Family Association. Let me bring in another voice to this conversation. Richard Cizik is Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the National Association of Evangelicals. That's an umbrella organization, has 51 denominations, 30 million members in the United States. And Richard Cizik, thank you. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Where do you come down on this argument?
That's a good question. I can sympathize with both gentlemen, both of whom I know and would count as friends. Let me say this. I'm in the unenviable position of having to both agree and disagree with both to a certain extent. So I find myself in the middle, which is where a lot of evangelicals are. To be precise, probably 58% of evangelicals consider themselves traditionalists. I think Tim is vocalizing their views. Probably around 30% in the middle centrist and 10 to 15% or 10% at least who are liberals. And Jim is probably in that category. So I find myself in the middle, if that makes any sense. And my one concern about those on the right, I think, when they protest is that sometimes they get identified with others who protest too much. For example, when I say Merry Christmas, I'm afraid because of some of the protests on the right, people will think, I'm ganging up on them. I'm engaging in some kind of an unseemly attempt to dominate the public square, and I don't think that's what really commends evangelicals. And I think it's excess when somebody puts up out in front of a church a sign that says, to hell with happy holidays. In other words, I don't want people to think, when I say Merry Christmas, to hell with them. Of course not. So it's all in how we do this. And, hey, my wife, family, we've participated in a Merry Christmas coat drive until we were told it had to be Happy Holidays coat drive, and I think that's wrong too. And as far as Jim, I'm with him in collaborating with all the other faith groups, and particularly Jews, on these subjects of Darfur and the rest. So I find myself in the middle. That's a long answer. I apologize.
Quickly elaborate a bit, if you can, on Happy Holidays. Why do you say that you have a problem with that?
I don't really have a problem with it, except to say in instances in which, in a community in which I live, Fredericksburg, Virginia, I don't think that one has to capitulate to all the broader, what I think are to a certain extent, political correctness trends to change what is an obvious attempt by a local school to meet human needs at Christmas to sort of happy holidays, when we're talking, as Tim would say, not just 80%, but almost entirely within the Christian faith who are attempting to reach out. Why do we have to suddenly, and maybe it isn't so suddenly, Charles Haynes says he's a First Amendment attorney at the First Amendment Center. This began in the 1960s. Do we have to give up all of our traditions here, I think?
Okay. Richard Cizik, again, Vice President of Governmental Affairs, National Association of Evangelicals. We'll come back to him and our other guests as well in just a couple of moments. On Reporter's Notebook a little bit later, New York's transit strike ended suddenly. We'll get a post-mortem and talk about what's to come. More in a moment on To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about what's been referred to as a war on Christmas by one of our guests who leads the American Family Association, which has asked its members to express their views to department stores that they think they are being anti-Christian and anti-Christmas when they use the phrase "Happy Holidays" and they don't mention the Christian holiday Christmas in their advertising and in their approaches to their customers. We've heard from Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners magazine, that that's missing the message of Christ, that what we ought to do is take care of the poor, when in fact the Congress and the Bush administration are cutting taxes for the rich and at the same time cutting benefits for the poor. Talking now with Richard Cizik, Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the National Association of Evangelicals. What about this phrase, war on Christmas? You said happy holidays seems to you to be a capitulation to political correctness. Is there, though, do you think, as Tim Wallace said, a conscious effort by secularists to take the Christ out of Christmas?
probably on the part of certain secularists, our own scholars would say yes. Well, maybe not just out of Christmas, but generally, the late Carl F. H. Henry, the 20th century's greatest theologian, was wont to say to me, Richard, he said, the secularist mindset has become a hardened will set. And so I sympathize with Tim's concern, but I have also said that I don't think the methodology that some folks use, such as the sign in front of a church I referred to earlier, is the way to go. In other words, to hell with the holidays. I think as evangelical Christians, we have to collaborate with Jews who I think feel that some of this language here is coded language against them. I mean, they have said so. And that's the last message I want people to get. So it's all in how you do it. Methodology is as important as principles.
Back to Tim Wildman, the president of the American Family Association. What about the possibility of being mistaken for anti-Semitism?
Well, you know, I don't think that Merry Christmas or the celebration of Christmas traditionally in America has been viewed as anti-Semitic. You know, I think you're really having to reach for that. I mean, I've had no problem with Happy Hanukkah, or you know, the honoring legitimate religious holidays like that in the public. If someone wants to put a menorah up on the county square, that's perfectly fine with me, and I think the vast majority of Christians in this country. So I don't buy the anti-Semitic argument at all.
Back to Jim Wallace of Sojourners Magazine. What about this point of Richard Cizik's that there's an element of political correctness involved in Happy Holidays? He says he doesn't want to capitulate to that.
Well, I've said on many occasions that there is a group in this country, I call them secular fundamentalists, and they're opposed to any kind of religion, people of faith, spirituality, particularly in politics. And I get beat up by those people, too. They don't want to hear about Martin King, Desmond Tutu, or anybody else. They want our life, our public life, to be totally secular, and they want to banish even talk of values from the public square. I mean, I have my fights with those people, too. But where do you take your stand? And taking our stand around shopping doesn't strike me as the place to stand. I mean, Mr. Wildman said, you know, that we have no responsibility for the poor or people on the road, or we do as Christians individually. I hope he doesn't think the government has no responsibility for what happens around the world, that we've for Darfur, for global poverty, for HIV/AIDS. We have no responsibility for global warming, for any of the things going on. Those aren't at all public responsibilities that we just take care of them in our neighborhood and charity and church. That's not a biblical point of view. That's a right-wing conservative point of view. Not a biblical. The Bible has a place for government, and faith-based organizations play a role. Families do, and so does government. So that's just bad theology. And what happens there is we don't care about the poor. We care about our language at the shopping malls. Now, this just doesn't ring true. I just did some Christmas shopping this afternoon, and I bought a few things for the kids. But I'll tell you, the whole environment of the shopping mall, is this really the frenzy that I just saw going on? Is this what honors welcoming Jesus Christ into a manger stall, whose mother Mary prophesied that he would turn things upside down? This is just cultural language put on top of shopping. And I think while there are real issues about secular fundamentalism, this is not the place where I want to take my stand.
So, Tim Wildman, back to you. What, then, is more Christian and more relevant to Christmas, shopping at the mall or being concerned about the poor?
Well,
and does the government have the kind of responsibilities Jim Wallace says it has?
Well, I resent Jim saying that I don't care about the poor or that conservatives or those on the Christian right don't care about the poor. I think you have a lot of social programs and government programs, and you can argue about how they are efficient or effective, are you getting more people addicted to the government? I think that's the argument that I would have, not necessarily that the government has no role whatsoever in helping the poor and the needy. I'm not in that camp at all, and I don't think nobody I know is. It's just that we see so many people becoming addicted to the welfare state, and we're concerned about that. That tears up families as much as anything. So we should care about the poor, and there is a role that the government does play. I'm not so nobody on our side is saying that I know is saying none whatsoever. I think we all have a role to play here, and nobody can do everything. And our guest, your other guest, may disagree with what we do and the tactics that we take and what the issues that we raise as priority. But we're one organization, and we feel like this is our calling. We're concerned about the secularization of the culture, and it's becoming more evident at Christmas time that many of the secularists are wanting to remove Christ from Christmas and Christmas from December, wanting to make everything generic. Everything's a holiday, which the second definition of that's Holy Day. So I guess that's next on the agenda to be removed from our vocabulary. So, and we believe that words have meaning, and so that's why we're taking a stand for Christmas. With respect to the corporate efforts, all we were saying was we found it interesting that these stores make 20-25% of their annual profits this time of year, and yet there's no mention of the word Christmas in any of their advertising, marketing, circulars. Merry Christmas signs weren't till recently even put up in the stores, but I guarantee you we'll have after Christmas sales in a few days. So that's what we're saying. This is one part of what we believe is the culture war.
Tim Wildman, again, president of the American Family Association, Traditional Values Organization. Our fourth guest on this program has been listening to this conversation since the outset is Mark Silk. He's director of the Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, also author of a couple of books, Unsecular Media, Making News of Religion in America, and Spiritual Politics, Religion in American Society Since World War II. Mark Silk, welcome to you.
Delighted to be here, Warren.
Put this discussion we're hearing in the context of history, if you will. Certainly, as we've just heard from Jim Wallace, there have been concerns for a long, long time about the commercialization of Christmas. Now we have, it seems to me this year, a different kind of emphasis from Tim Wildman and others. How does this fit in terms of the continuity of the nation?
Well, I think where the nation starts off is with the Puritan fathers, who had no use for Christmas celebrations at all. They really saw it as a Catholic holiday, a mass. If words have meaning, Christmas is Christ's mass. And they thought it was just too much a kind of wild celebration where people did what Catholics tend to do in major festivities, or at least used to in Mediterranean lands, get a party down and have a good time. And for the good Puritans of Massachusetts, that was just something they didn't want any part of on theological grounds, on behavioral grounds, and so on. Christmas as a holiday celebrated broadly in American society comes in the 19th century under the influence of other immigrant groups, Germans and Dutch, and so we have Santa Claus, who's kind of a Dutch character, and we have evergreens, which tends to be from Northern Europe, from the forests of Germany, and so on. And there was considerable debate back at that early time, particularly, and here, I think Jim Wallace is talking an old story of just turning this holiday into a great commercial enterprise, and so the big new department stores, Wanamaker's and Macy's and so on in the 19th century, did huge Christmas displays, and it became this grand domestic holiday for the American middle class. We've now moved into another era, and the terms of the debate have changed, but the fact of a debate about Christmas remains the same.
Mark Silk at the Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life at Trinity College in Hartford. So you don't see then that the terms of the debate really are changing, even though the language sounds different.
No, I think the terms have changed. It's a sort of different debate. I think we still fight about Christmas and worry about its meaning. I do think that there is a. I mean, I don't have a lot of. Patience with the idea that there's a war on Christmas. But I do think that there is a contest for the public square. And in that sense, I would agree with Mr. Wildman that there is a kind of culture war going on here, and it really has to do with how we define the common spaces where we meet. And I think it's not... what's to some people political correctness is to other people good manners.
and how one relates to an increasingly diverse society. The number of people who celebrate Christmas may be in the 90s, if one takes a certain view of it. But in terms of the number of Americans these days who consider themselves and call themselves Christian to pollsters, when you call them up, the best numbers are around 77%. There are quite a few people who, in fact, the largest portion of the people who are left, that is the 23%, are people who claim to have no religion or to be indifferent to it. And then there are various minority faiths, not only Jews, but Hindus, Buddhists, and so on. And I think what the commercial establishments are doing is sort of recognizing a society which is diverse, but it's a recognition which has been building over quite a good long time. When Jerry Falwell and others who began the sort of evangelical turn to politics at the end of the 1970s did, they tended to talk not about the importance of the society being based on Christian values, but on Judeo-Christian values. And so there's a wide effort to try to be inclusive in that way. But, you know, this is a real debate, not a pseudo-debate, about how we define our public spaces.
Mark Silk, again, Director of the Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life at Trinity College, Hartford. Richard Cizik, back to you, Vice President, Governmental Affairs for the National Association of Evangelicals. Just interested in your take on the history and the Puritan fathers of the country who didn't want to celebrate Christmas at all, saw it as a Catholic celebration and very much not in the spirit of Christ as they understood it. Where does that position stand, or are there still people in this country that adhere to that, and are evangelicals among them?
Oh, absolutely. The history Mark recounted is exactly right. We know that history changed with Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol, etc. In other words, Christmas became something about children. It became something about how we identify ourselves, and the old Puritan asceticism went by the way of all flesh. So, yes, it is a different kind of holiday than our Puritan forefathers held, and yet many evangelicals, you're right, still rebel against that. I do. I was out like Jim today doing some of those last-minute shopping trips, and I rebel against the commercialization, too. And so I feel myself in as an evangelical with a foot in both camps, both in the boycott, although I don't always approve a boycott camp that Tim Wildman is in, as well as Jim Wallace is concerned about commercialization. Look, Christmas is not just any old holiday, and I think it's wrong when we deny our children the right to celebrate Christmas even in their public schools. So with a foot in both camps, I think my cautionary word here, if there's any, it's about methodology. And my favorite verse, frankly, is Luke 1:78-79, which 78 and 79, which the tender mercy of God with which the sunrise from on high shall visit us to shine upon those who sit in darkness, those who sit in darkness and the shadow of death, those in Darfur, places like that. This tender mercies of God come, you see, to guide our feet into the way of peace. And that is my desire at this time of year, that we present a model of peacemaking, of a witness, even at times a very quiet witness that doesn't engage in the commercialization, that shows other people who don't show our faith really what we are about. We want to be winsome most of all. I think fundamentally Tim wants that, Jim wants that. We as evangelicals, we all are here, want to show the real love that we have for other people.
Mark Silk, back to you at Trinity College. Earlier, Tim Wildman, or actually a couple of times, has made the point that if the department stores, in fact, make 20% to 25% of their profits at Christmas time, he assumes that's because people are doing Christmas shopping and says they simply ought to recognize that. Have you heard that argument before?
No, I haven't. I think it's fine, and, you know, the stores will do what they do. Maybe they'll revert to Christmas. You know, but I would like to just return to one point. The concern that Tim raised and that others raised in this discussion about, you know, secularism in the society, I think has to be put in the context of American society as being based on some important secularist principles. And one of the most important ones that I think the vast majority of evangelicals, as well as other religious Americans, embrace is the one that we shouldn't have any official religion in this country. Going back historically, that would have been and was regarded as a hideously secularist point of view, and one in which no society could possibly function unless there was an established religion. We don't believe that in this country. We've done quite well without one. Certainly evangelical Protestants have done very well without one, and I think they will continue to do well whether Target or any other store has Happy Holidays up on its banner or Merry Christmas.
Tim Wildman with the American Family Association. Should the United States have an official religion?
Well, no, we shouldn't have an official religion, but we have an official holiday. It's called Christmas. It's a federal holiday. It has been since 1870. So somewhere back there then, they didn't have a problem with recognizing the birth of Christ as a federal holiday. So maybe they interpreted church-state relations a little bit differently than we do today. So, if we're going to be inclusive, let's include Christmas. Let's include Merry Christmas. Let's include the Christian tradition and the celebration of the birth of Christ. I think what we get with political correctness, at least in part, the definition is, in order not to offend the vast minority, we offend the vast majority. And I think that's the cry of a lot of people I hear out here in the country, is that who are tired of that part of political correctness is, hey, we've had these traditions, we've had these time-honored celebrations, and why are they being watered down, taken away, and attacked? And that people don't understand it, and they're frustrated with it. And it does find that going on in different places, including the retail industry, for instance. I mentioned that. Some being mocked at. But I'm telling you, in the schools and in government houses, people resent the fact that their traditions are being taken away.
Okay. And Jim Wallace, back to you with Sojourner's final comment here. Your concern is the traditions are not being applied by the Bush administration and Congress.
Well, the gospel I believe in doesn't need the protection of a nation, the U.S. government, or Target. In fact, have Merry Christmas emblazoned over shopping center malls is not the honoring of Christ. It's the co-optation. It's the cultural accommodation of Christmas to the marketplace. If you want to put Christ back in Christmas, this sounds like a campaign to put Jesus Christ back in the shopping malls. Putting Christ back in the Christmas is a very different thing. It would be stop the shopping. Stop all the shopping. Focused on the Christ child who comes as the hope of the world, to change the world, to bring peace in the midst of war and conflict, to bring hope to those who have no hope. And that applies to our individual decisions, our family choices, our churches, and our stance to those situations around the world that today know no peace, know no comfort, and are begging for the good news of Jesus Christ. And that is something different, like welcome to Christmas, and don't miss a 20% off sale.
We are going to leave it at that. Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners Magazine, Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association, Richard Cizik, vice president of governmental affairs for the National Association of Evangelicals, and Mark Silk, director of the Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life, Trinity College, Hartford. Thank you all very much for being with us today. Trains, buses, and subways are rolling again in New York City after a three-day strike that frustrated 7 million commuters and holiday shoppers in the dead of winter. Negotiators are back at the bargaining table. Will workers be penalized for breaking the law? What's the message for labor relations with public employees? More in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Marmon Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. New York's transit strikes seem headed into a lengthy stalemate, but yesterday it ended abruptly. Many striking transit workers simply laid down their placards and walked into the buildings they had been picketing. That's according to a story by Stephen Greenhouse in today's New York Times. And Stephen, thanks very much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
A couple of weeks ago, as this was all shaping up, you wrote this: it almost seems scripted. What did you mean by that?
When there are transit negotiations in New York City every 3 years, there's a series of events that always seem to take place. Each side does a lot of posturing. Then the union casts a strike authorization vote. Then the two sides meet in a hotel, and they bargain late into the night. And then they approach the strike deadline. And then usually they don't go on. There isn't a strike, but this time, unfortunately, there was.
You said once again a week or two ago that there was the potential for irrationality. Is that what happened? Did irrationality take over?
Some people would say yes, it did. In fact, the two sides are fairly close right before the strike deadline Tuesday morning, yet they couldn't get to yes, as some people say. I think the union very much wanted to show its assertiveness. It wanted to show it demanded respect. And even though not much money divided the two sides, it walked out and it paralyzed the nation's largest transit system. And a lot of people would say that was an irrational decision, that was a fit of pique.
What about the MTA, which has, as I understand it, a budget surplus, or it's supposed to at least, of $1 billion?
The MTA, the New York's Transit Authority that runs the subways and buses, had a $1 billion surplus this year, and it distributed it in many ways, some of it for the workers. And the union, the Transit Workers Union, said it's crazy, it's unfair for the authority to demand major concessions on pensions and health when it had a surplus. Now, the authority's response, and it's a legitimate response, is that looking 2, 3, 4 years ahead, it's going to have sizable deficits, and it needs to get those under control now.
What about public opinion? Was there a substantial public support for the transit workers, even though, of course, it was the public that was the big loser?
I've seen polls, and the public is really split. It's surprising. Some really like the union leader, an immigrant from Trinidad, a very, you know, tough, truculent guy who says, I'm trying to help working-class Americans. I'm trying to prevent them from losing concessions. And I think New York's very large immigrant community, its large blue-collar community, often sympathize with him. But a lot of people thought, oh, it stinks not to be able to take the trains. I think, you know, wealthier New Yorkers, white-collar New Yorkers probably showed less sympathy. I think there was somewhat of a class divide going on.
I was going to ask about that. Again, we're talking with Stephen Greenhouse, reporter for the New York Times. Your paper editorializes today using the phrase, a clash of race, culture, and class. You don't write the editorials, but I'm interested in your take on that. To what extent was this a clash of race, culture, and class?
In ways it's unclear. The Transit Workers Union is 70% black, Hispanic minority in general. And they have a feeling that they are not shown enough respect. And they're always, you know, lashing out at the transportation authority saying, we want more respect. Now, I think the racial issue really came to the fore in the strike when Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York described or denounced the strikers or the strike leaders as thuggish or having acted thuggishly. And for some, you know, blacks, for some African Americans, that's a code word, and they see it as racist. And they said the mayor was being unfair, and, you know, Reverend Al Sharpton and others jumped on the mayor for not showing enough respect to this largely minority union.
So an enormously complex issue, and of course also the fact is writ large here that, as you say, every 3 years there's posturing, then there's a strike vote, but strikes are illegal by public employees. How is it that this strike vote gets called every 3 years and sometimes, as we've seen this week, even acted on?
Warren, that's a very good question. The strike vote is just by the executive board of the union, and I was telling some friends of mine, if the rank and file of the union were to vote on whether to strike, they very possibly would not have voted in favor of a strike. I think the executive board of the union very much backs the union's president and you know, were willing to go along where they led him. You know, for the workers, one of the big problems in the strike is they're fined 2 days' pay for each day they're on strike. So the workers who are out 3 days now lose 6 days' pay, which would be over $1,000.
Do you think that there will be any willingness on anybody's part to forgive that and not have them fined and pay that very large amount?
My understanding is the law prohibits amnesty. A judge cannot just say, we're going to throw out the fines. It would take an act of the state legislature, as I understand it, to lift the fines on the individual workers.
Strikes by public employees have been illegal in New York for a long, long time. They are illegal in a lot of places, and some places don't even allow collective bargaining by public employees. What's your understanding of the theory behind allowing collective bargaining but not allowing the strike, which is the main weapon that unions have?
I guess many state and cities feel that they're doing their employees a favor by letting them form unions. You know, the federal National Labor Relations Act governs labor relations for private workers, not government workers. And I guess the bargain that many states and cities created with their workers is, we'll give you the right to form unions, we'll give you the right to bargain collectively, but we're not going to give you the right to go on strike. Now, none of us wants to see police or firefighters or transit workers go on strike because they really do provide essential services. So I think there's, you know, extraordinary resistance to letting certain groups of workers, you know, go on strike. It's one thing for workers at a supermarket, say, to go on strike. It's another thing for, you know, the police to go on strike, for the teachers to go on strike. And I think that's what many government officials feel, that it's fair to bar strikes by public employees.
A lot of issues affect people all over the country in highly dramatic form in New York City, as we have seen many times. Stephen Greenhouse, thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Warren.
Labor and workplace reporter for the New York Times. Producers of To the Point, Christian Bordahl, Francis Anderton, Katie Cooper, Ileana Justice, Jonah King, Sherman Rimbaugh, managing producer Cameron Radziner. Thanks to the John Coltrane family, technical director Mike Newport. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.